Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka again, another episode, reading from Sri Aurobindo, Essays on the Gita. Continuing with philosophy, because I manifest, I am, and because I transcend manifestation, I am. The formula is not so clear and catching as the Cartesian, but there is a fuller truth in its greater comprehensiveness. The man of unalloyed intellect has a very high and difficult function. It is his function to teach men to think clearly and purely. In order to effect that for mankind, to carry reason as far as that somewhat stumbling and hesitating Pegasus will go, he sacrifices all the bypaths of mental enjoyment, the shady alleys and the moonlit gardens of the soul, in order that he may walk in rare air and a cold sunlight, living highly and austerely on the peaks of his mind and seeking God severely through knowledge. He treads down his emotions because emotion distorts reason and replaces it by passions, desires, preferences, prejudices, prejudgments. He avoids life because life awakes all his sensational being and puts his reason at the mercy of egoism, of sensational reactions of anger, fear, hope, hunger, ambition, instead of allowing it to act justly and do disinterested work. It becomes merely the paid pleader of a party, a cause, a creed, a dogma, an intellectual faction. Passion and eagerness, even intellectual eagerness, so disfigure the greatest minds that even Shankara becomes a sophist and a word twister, and even Buddha argues in a circle. The philosopher wishes above all to preserve his intellectual righteousness. He is, or should be, as careful of his mental rectitude as the saint of his moral stainlessness. Therefore, he avoids, as far as the world will let him, the conditions which disturb. But in this way, he cuts himself off from experience, and only the gods can know without experience. C.A.S. has said that politics was a subject of which he had made science. Well, he had, but the pity was that though he knew the science of politics perfectly, he did not know politics itself in the least. And when he did enter political life, he had formed too rigidly the logical habit to replace it in any degree by the practical. If he had reversed the order, or at least coordinated experiment with his theories before they were formed, he might have succeeded better. His ready-made constitutions are monuments of logical perfection and practical ineffectiveness. They have the weakness of all logic. Granting your premises, your conclusion is all triumphant. But then who is going to grant you your premises? There's nothing fact and destiny delight in so much as upsetting the logicians major and minor. The logician thinks he has insured himself against error when he has made a classification of particular fallacies. But he forgets the supreme and general fallacy, the fallacy of thinking that logic can, as a rule, prove anything but particular and partial propositions dealing with a fragmentary and one-sided truth. Logic? The truth is not logical. It contains logic, but is not contained by it. A particular syllogism may be true so far as it goes, covering a sharply limited set of facts, but even a set of syllogisms cannot exhaust truth on a general subject, for the simple reason that they necessarily ignore a number of equally valid premises, facts, or possibilities which support a modified or contrary view. Now, if one could arrive first at a conclusion, then at its exact opposite, and finally harmonize the contradiction, one might arrive at some approach to the truth. But this is a process logic abhors. Its fundamental conception is that two contradictory statements cannot be true at the same time and place and in the same circumstances. Now, fact, nature, and God laugh aloud when they hear the logician state his fundamental conception. For the universe is based on the simultaneous existence of contradictions, covering the same time, place, and circumstances. The elementary conception that God is at once one and many, finite and infinite, formed and formless, and that each attribute is the condition of the existence of its opposite. That's a thing that metaphysical logic has been boggling over ever since the reign of reason began. The metaphysician thinks that he has got over the difficulty about the validity of premises by getting to the tattvas, the ideal truths of universal existence. Afterwards, he thinks, there can be no fear of confusion or error, and by understanding and fixing them, we shall be able to proceed from a sound basis to the rest of our task. He fashions his critique of reason, his system of pramanas, and launches himself into the wide inane. Alas, the tattvas are the very foundation, support, and initial reason of this worldwide contradiction and logically impossible conciliation of opposites in which God has shadowed out some few rays of his luminous and infinite reality. Impossible to bind with the narrow links of a logical chain, precisely because it is infinite. As for the pramanas, their manipulation is the instrument of all difference of opinion and the accompaniment to an unending jangle of debate. Both the logician and philosopher are apt to forget that they are dealing with words, and words divorced from experience can be the most terrible misleaders in the world. Precisely because they are capable of giving us so much light, they are also capable of lighting us into impenetrable darkness. Deeper is the darkness into which they enter who are addicted to knowledge alone. Deeper is the darkness into which they enter who are addicted to knowledge alone. This sort of word worship and its resultant luminous darkness is very common in India, and nowhere more than in the intellectualities of religion. So that when a man talks to me about the One and Maya and the Absolute, I am tempted to ask him, "My friend, how much have you experienced of these things in which you instruct me? Or how much are you telling me out of a vacuum or merely from intellectual appreciation?" If you have merely ideas and no experience, you are no authority for me, and your logic is to me but the clashing of cymbals, good to deafen an opponent into silence, but of no use for knowledge. If you say you have experience, then I have to ask you, are you sure you have measured all possible experience? If you have not, then how can you be sure that my contradictory experience is not equally true? And if you say you have, then I know you to be deluded or a pretender, one who has experienced a fragment or nothing. For God in his entire being is unknowable. Avijnatam vijnatam. Now the scientist thinks he has corrected the mistakes of the metaphysician because he refuses to deal with anything but a narrow and limited circle of facts and condemns everything else as hallucination, imposture, imagination. His fierce and settled prejudgments, his determined begging of the question are too obvious and well known to need particular illustration. He forgets that all experiences are facts, and that ideas are facts, that subjective knowledge is the one fact of which he can be decently sure, and that he knows nothing, even of the material world, by his senses, but only by the use of subjective knowledge makes of the senses. Many a materialist will tell you that only those facts can be accepted as a basis to knowledge which the senses supply, a position which no man can substantiate and which his science daily denies in practice. These reasoners consent to trust to their sovereign's objective instrument when it settles for them the truths about this world visible to their lower instruments. But the same sovereign instrument is condemned as wholly fallacious and insane when it deals in precisely the same way with another field of perceptions and experiences. We will pause at this point for today and continue next week, same time, same station, with Essays on the Gita by Sri Aurobindo. Thank you for listening. May your day be filled with light. May your life be filled with this light. That's all for now.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.